Please welcome to the stage 2009-2010 Council of State Archivist President and Director of the State Archives and Library Division, Kansas State Historical Society, Patricia Michaelis.
Well, we're in for a treat this morning. Juan Williams has risen to the top of the media as one of our most accomplished writers, thinkers, and journalists. Bridging the political spectrum with ease, William conveys a knowledgeable perspective of the news that is grounded in truth and facts. His experience spans more than 20 years, ranging from his tenure at the Washington Post, where he served as an award-winning editorial writer, op-ed columnist, and White House correspondent, to his current role as senior correspondent for National Public Radio and a political analyst for Fox News. He understands the hot-button topics that affect the way we live and do business. From 2000 to 2001, Juan Williams hosted NPR's national call-in show, Talk of the Nation. In that role, he brought the program to cities and towns across America for monthly radio town hall meetings before live audiences. The town hall meetings were part of The Changing Face of America, a year-long NPR series focused on how Americans are dealing with rapid changes in society and culture as the United States enters the 21st century. He is also a user of archives. Williams is the author of the critically acclaimed biography, Thurgood Marshall, American Revolutionary, which was released in paperback in February 2000. He wrote the nonfiction bestseller, Eyes on the Prize, America's Civil Rights Years, 1954 to 1965, the companion volume to the critically acclaimed television series. This Far by Faith, Stories from the African-American Religious Experience, appeared in February of 2000 and served as the basis for a six-part public broadcasting TV documentary that aired in June 2003. In 2004, he became involved with AARP's Voices of the Civil Rights Project, leading a veteran team of reporters and editors in production of My Soul Looks Back in Wonder, Voices of the Civil Rights Experience. The book presents eyewitness accounts of some 50 activists who served as foot soldiers and field generals in the civil rights movement. His 2006 book, entitled Enough, The Phony Leaders, Dead-End Movements, and Culture of Failure That Are Undermining Black America and What We Can Do About It, ignited a nationwide debate. This amazing litany of accomplishments reinforces the need for us as archivists to be diligent in collecting materials of underrepresented groups and social and political movements so they may be used by others for similar projects. Not one to avoid debate, Williams is a contributing political analyst for the Fox News Channel and a regular panelist on Fox News Sunday. He has appeared on numerous television programs, including Nightline, Washington Week in Review, CNN's Crossfire, where he frequently served as co-host, and Capital Gang Sunday. Please join me in welcoming Juan Williams.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much. Thank you. Pat, as you were saying all those nice things about me, I was thinking the same thing. Just so nice. You know, welcome to Washington. This is such an interesting time to be here. It's wonderful for me to be able just to walk around, and even in this grand hotel, and say hello to so many people. You know, I'm literally like a walking Rorschach test, because lots of people come up to me and they say, "Hey, I watch you on Fox. You're just terrific. You know, I just love watching you on Fox." And at the next moment, someone will come up to me and say, "Hey, you're Juan Williams. You're the voice on NPR." And I think, what if these two people ever met each other? And of course, overwhelming for this crowd is you're an NPR crowd. So what happens is people come up to me and they say, wow, you know, I really didn't know what you looked like. Which is another, you know, big clue that they don't watch TV. So then they say, well, it's just so great to be able to put a face with the voice. At which point, I bite through my tongue. Because, you know, there's a little bit of a wise guy in me. And the wise guy wants to say, you know, I didn't know what you looked like either. But you guys look great, I'll tell you that, you know? You guys look great. This hotel is also a fun hotel. I've never stayed in this hotel because I live in Washington. But I come and I speak to people here. There are big events here in this hotel. And it has a tremendous history. And one of my favorite things about it is, you know, that when people stay in hotels like this, I remember once a friend said to me, you know, I'm going to have a hard time checking out of that hotel. I said, why is that? He said, the towels are so fluffy, I won't be able to close my suitcase. But I always think this is one of the grand hotels from the era when you would have people come to Washington, senators living in Washington, Supreme Court justices who would not bother to have a home here but just to live in hotels. This hotel and the Omni Shoreham across the way fit that bill. They've been here now, you know, almost the entirety of the 20th century. Of course, they've been renovated and changed in so many ways, but the hotels, the building themselves, have such history. And I think to myself as I'm speaking to you, America's archivist, about living history, about being in a place where history is made. For example, you know, it impacts corporate memory. How we remember is such a powerful act. Let me just give you a clue about this. In my job as a journalist, I was fairly close when President Obama was inaugurated on the steps of the Capitol. So people all the time will say to me, Juan, what was it like for you to be so close to President Obama when he was inaugurated? You're black, he's black, you've written all these books about black history, it must have been such a poignant moment for you. What was it like? And I say, you know, it was really, really cold. And then they look at me because they think I'm not being a serious person. They think, wow, he's a silly man. Well, you know, don't pull my leg. What was it like for you? And I said, well, you don't understand. The musicians couldn't play their music that day. They had to have recorded music because it was so cold. And they, you know, they were afraid the reeds would pop and the strings would break. So even though these famous musicians looked like they were playing, it was actually recorded music. And then they say, oh, no, 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 that's not what I'm talking about. What was it like for you? And I, you know, at that point I'm thinking, well, you know, that's what I remember. But anyway, and then they, you know, I thought, well, maybe I used humor. So what I've taken to doing is I say to them, you know what, it was so cold that day, the politicians were walking around with their hands in their own pockets. It was that cold. Then I think they start to get, you know, hey. I just, you know, had a thought as I was coming in to speak with you, which is that my son, who's now 30 years old, once came home from school and said to me, he said, Dad, what's the biggest building in Washington? So I said, Tony, I think you mean, you know, like the Capitol is on Capitol Hill and no building in Washington by statute is supposed to be taller than the Capitol. Is that what you're talking about, Tony? He said, no. I said, well, are you talking about like going over to the National Cathedral, which is thought of as being the high point in terms of the topography? He said, no, Dad, the biggest building in Washington. I said, okay, I give up, Tony. What's the biggest building in Washington? He said, the National Archives. I said, the National Archives? Why? He says, it has the most stories. Well, that worked for Tony. You know, for me, as a writer, I think it was Borges who said that for him, heaven really would be a library. But I must tell you, for me, it's always been the thought that heaven would be a great archive. Because for someone who's a writer, what all of you do in terms of collecting material makes possible what I do both as a journalist and as a writer, as a historian. So for me, all of you are literally, well, if it's a heaven, if archives are a heaven, you guys must be the angels, because you guys make archives happen. And so I come to you, when I come to an archive, in search of basic material that allows me to have an understanding of my subject and of a time and of a place, but even more so to have an understanding of what I'm trying to create going forward in terms of our memory, our understanding of who we are as an American people. Archives shape history. Archives shape culture. Archives shape ideas. And of course, when I'm talking to you about this, I'm talking to you in large part about the fact that today, this country is in the midst of such terrific change. There's so many demands being made on who we are as an American people. Our identity itself is in flux. And that makes the notion of memory, the notion and importance of archives, all the more central to going forward. Not just looking back, but going forward. When I'm talking to you about the changes in terms of the demographics, I'm talking to you about the idea that we are such a fast-growing country at this time. I'm still amazed at the census report that we are now a country of more than 300 million people. We've never been such a populous nation. And according to census, if you look forward, it will soon be a day, I guess in about 15 to 20 years, when we're a country of 400 million people. So the rate of growth is tremendous. And when you look at this growth and start to try to understand where it's coming from, it's overwhelmingly coming from young people. Young people. Quarter of the population under the age of 18. That's stunning to me. At 56, I don't know that many people under the age of 18. I don't even have kids under the age of 18. Of course, when I tell this to my colleagues at NPR and elsewhere, I say, you know, what's it? Did you know that there's so many people under 18 in this country? They all snicker. They say, oh, of course. Haven't you been to the mall recently? You know? It's all Abercrombie and Fitch and Old Navy and Gap. That's who the retailers are selling to. They're not selling to you and me. Or as my wife famously put it, have you tried on a pair of jeans recently? She said, they won't fit your butt, buddy, I tell you that. They're not made for you, they're made for the young people. And of course, if you've gone to the movies recently, as someone once told me, all those vampires are not there for you and me. They don't make movies for people my age anymore, so I guess they're making them for kids. But it's just stunning to me that there's so many young people. And I mention this to you in large part because those young people don't have memory. They don't know so much of the history. They're not in touch with so much of the past. So they come into this moment, those who are curious, searching for an understanding of who we are as an American people. And let me stop here and emphasize this point, that when you look at who these young people are, those under 18 and even going forward, the so-called millennials, people under the age of 32, what you'll find is that they're disproportionately immigrants, minorities, and poor, surprisingly poor. And they're concentrated in our big cities. Stop and think about this population. oftentimes struggling through poor education, but struggling to have this sense of identity as Americans. Struggling to get a sense of what it means to be an American, struggling to get in touch with our history. Our history, the entire history of the country. Not to see it as the history of white people who were here, or the founding fathers, but to see it as pertinent to who we are at this moment. That archives are living, that archives are a point of creativity, a spark for the imagination. That is all part of that generation coming into touch with who we are and how they impact us as a society. And I think to myself, that group of young people, of course, is also in touch with the idea that, well, the archives seem to be the province of the older generation. And I think to myself, well, why do they have that feeling? Why do they think that archives are sort of old, dusty, musky place? Why do they have that notion? Of course, you know, you have to understand that the other end of the demographic that's driving so much of the change in this country at the moment might be best encapsulated in the idea that the AARP has something they call the 2011 Council. Because 2011, next year, is the first year in which the baby boomers turn age 65. And after that, buddy, it's just like Great Falls or Niagara Falls. So many people going over, if you know what I mean. It's going to be incredible. And that population is going to be about a quarter of the American population in another 20 years. So imagine, you have it, if you will, in the imagination, like a barbell. You know, it's heavily weighted on one end with so many young people and heavily weighted on the other end with so many seniors. And there's a competition of imagination and memory about the direction of the country, about who we are, about how we discover our future together. There are political tensions between these two, generational tensions. You can see it here in Washington play out over issues ranging from the high cost of prescription drugs, remember the prescription drug benefit, or the viability of Social Security. Young people generally don't believe that Social Security will be around to serve them. The seniors think they are entitled to Social Security that they paid in. They can't understand why anybody would threaten it. So you have these generational tensions that are so real in terms of that political spectrum. And oftentimes, it plays into the fact that that older generation is overwhelmingly white. Only 19% of that older generation is made up of people of color. But if you come to the younger end of the spectrum, to those young people, especially in our big cities, now you're approaching a population that's overwhelmingly black, Latino, Asian, immigrant. Easily in the top 38 cities in the country, more than half, in fact, more than two-thirds in some cases, of that population fits the category, as I described it, black, Latino, Asian, immigrant. That's a very strong tension at this moment in American society. And it plays out in terms of understanding who we are and having that sense of common purpose, common identity that marks us as Americans. And of course, when I talk to you about the change that's taking place in the society, I could throw in, obviously, the economic changes that we all face. What an amazing, amazing moment this is in American history in terms of economic change. Even here in Washington, If you were to go back, let's say, 100 years, you'd be surprised how quickly you would have been able to get out into tobacco fields in Virginia, horse farms in Maryland, even where I live in Northwest Washington, near Walter Reed Army Hospital. Gosh, that was, at that time, 100 years ago, considered a vacation spot, especially during this time of year, August in Washington, with all the heat and humidity. That's where the government officials would ride in their carriages to get away from the heat. That's where President Lincoln's summer house was, out on the grounds of the old soldiers' home. So you understand what a different place it was in the economy at that time, based on agriculture, an agrarian society. You come forward in time, you know, and over the course of the last 100 years, and it becomes much more of an industrial base. And then you come forward again and you go through World War II and then the GI Bill, higher levels of education, Washington is a booming place, government expansion, especially with the war effort. You come forward yet again and you start to see an economy that's based much more on the service sector, then of course much more of an information-based economy. You come forward yet again and then it becomes a high-tech economy. I think now they describe what we have as an innovation economy, but innovation in the sense that it's based so much on chemistry, pharmaceuticals, technology, the combination of them, human genome mapping, you know, amazing things, cloning, all of this. And, of course, the drugs, you know, gosh, what an amazing array of drugs they're offering us these days, you know. But that's the forefront of an American economy. You stop and think about it. They have drugs that will grow hair on your head, you know, drugs that will lower your cholesterol. And if Pat wasn't here, I'd tell you what they have drugs that will do. You know, archivists are such a decent crowd, I don't want to offend anybody. Because, you know, but let me think. I'll put it to you this way. If this speech should last longer than 4.5 hours, you should seek immediate medical attention. So they have amazing pills, but what the pills also signifies a change in terms of the economy, because to take part in this economy, you really do have to have an education. You really do have to have a sense of being a participant in a global economic structure. And this brings me back to those young people, disproportionately minorities, immigrants, and impoverished, struggling with education. Half of the black and Hispanic kids dropping out of high school, not being in touch so much with our corporate memory, but struggling for day-to-day survival. Those young people, I think, would be strangers in an archive. They don't have a sense of belonging in the archives, or that the archives speak to them and help to inform them about who they are, and maybe more important, because I think, as I say, archives as a place of imagination, they don't understand that archives could help them to understand who they might be, what they might become. So it's with that in mind that when I talk to you as archivists, I really am talking to you about being players in terms of maintaining American identity, being people who are at the forefront of helping us in this moment of tremendous stress and change on the society and everything from our demographics to our politics to our economics, to maintain a stable sense of who we are and who we might be, to inform us. And I say that with some special passion, because I come to your facilities, I use your product, and without you, I can't do my job. But more so, I speak to you as someone who has a real fascination with black history in this country, to say that black history and preservation of the record of black history in this country has been neglected for a long time. You know, you stop and think about it. When I'm doing work, even if I go to the old newspapers, sometimes the newspapers have not been kept because they were regarded as, well, just the black newspaper. And even if you then get the white newspaper for that period of time, early 20th century, let's say, it could be that a black person's life and death was not regarded as worthy of coverage, not worthy to be written about. Sometimes you'll see an obituary and you say, oh my gosh, here's a black person, but it's a black person who's written about in terms of their relationship to white people. Miss Betsy was the maid to such and such a family. Mr. George was the chauffeur for such and such a wealthy white family. And then you come to middle of the 20th century, and you start to see television's emergence, and you think, well, there will be coverage of the civil rights movement, and that coverage will, of course, then inform my understanding of this critical shift that was taking place mid-century with regard to American culture and politics, touching on segregation. But you find that, one, oftentimes the TV cameras weren't covering it, and two, no one regarded the tape as worthy of being preserved. So they threw out the old tape, or they reused it at the time, and then they trashed it. Again, no sense of the importance of archival material. Then you come forward from that, and you come to people getting involved with genealogy, you know, Roots. Remember when Roots was such a hit back in the 70s, and suddenly then turning on to the idea, well, wait a minute, those archives are informing us about who we are because they do tell us something about family history. People reluctant to take the next step and say it tells us something generally about our history as a society, as an American people. And now you again come to understand that for someone like me, in terms of the telling of the tale of American history, and in specific black American history, I can't do my job very well if I don't have archivists who have an interest in telling and preserving the diversity of the American experience, making sure that Miss Betsy or Mr. George are more than someone's servant, but that in fact these are people who lived lives and contributed to their society and raised families and struggled and wrote letters and told stories that communicated their experience as Americans across generations, and that for me to discover, to reach in and touch them and spark my mind as a writer is just so critical if I'm to help this generation to have a sense of belonging, and that their experience is as American as anyone else's experience. But it's so critical, I think, to have this understanding that history and the archives are really a function that helps us to understand who we are. I'll give you an example of this. When I was writing Eyes on the Prize, America's Civil Rights Years, I would find myself in situations where the written record, the historical record, was lacking. So I would do interviews. And the interviews were critical because, you can imagine, these are elderly people, and they're passing on, and you want to make sure that you capture their recollections for the record. But here's my experience. someone would say to me, "Oh yes, I was there. Nothing would have happened if I wasn't there. Oh yes, Dr. King was here, but guess what? I was here, and really, the only time he was here was when I was there to see him here. And guess what? Nothing else that those people did really mattered. I don't even like those people. I don't even know what they were up to, but it wasn't that important. You should just listen to my story, and you should understand it from my perspective. And at that moment, as the writer, I want to pull my hair out because I know that I am being spun around and distorted and subjected to someone's specific and maybe genuine memory, but it's so flawed. And then there's this. I can be with a group of writers and talking about history. And the writers, I will come to understand, really are reflecting their own experience. For example, if you look at books that have been written about the civil rights movement of the middle and late 20th century, they're written overwhelmingly by people who love the civil rights movement, people who admire the idea of the civil rights movement, and in many cases, people who were participants in the civil rights movement, either directly or on its fringes. Let's say they were in college during that period, and very admiring of things like Freedom Summer, Freedom Rides. So, guess what? Those people will celebrate the likes of Ella Baker, people who helped to create the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, young people at the time. They will celebrate Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner because they were of a similar age at that time when those three young men were killed, and it made such a powerful impact on them. They will know the story of Emmett Till, the teenager who was killed in Mississippi for whistling or calling out to a white woman, because they were a teenager at that time, and the story made such a strong emotional impression on them. They will know the story of Malcolm X and defiance and someone who is a strong black man who will stand up and tell white people to go to hell because they had that same desire to let out and speak out and not be submissive in a culture that expected them to be second-class citizens. So all the writing then about the civil rights movement becomes an extension of their sense and expression, their desire to tell a strong tale about what happened in what is now described as the greatest social movement that America has ever seen, the civil rights movement. And I remember when I was getting going on Eyes on the Prize, the man who had created the concept of Eyes on the Prize was a man named Henry Hampton in Boston. And Henry invited me to come up and talk to him about how I would tell the story of the American Civil Rights Movement. And I said to him, I said, "Henry, you know, you've got all these young people here who were already trying to put together schools with people who were activists from the period and go out and get some archival material where it existed for the film." I said, "They're all so upbeat and so enthusiastic, and it feels almost like, you know, they're involved in the civil rights movement, and they want to paint these dramatic pictures of heroes and villains." And I said, "You know, Henry, I don't think there's any need for us to be, you know, sort of lecturing to the audience. I think if we just tell this story as it happened, the heroes and the villains will emerge. I don't think there's any need to gild the lily here." And I tell you the truth, I obviously as a black person care deeply about the progress we've made, but I think it's a mistake for us to become so ideological. So I said this to him, and I didn't think I would ever get the job, and I left, and sure enough, he called me a week or so later and said, I really think that's the way we need to go. I'd like you to come up here and write this book for me. Help me tell this story. And I was so pleased, but I found myself time and again up against people who felt as if, given the absence of information, given the fact that this story hadn't been told, that there's so much black history just missing, not only from archives, but subsequently then from American history and American history books, that there was a real attitude about telling the tale. Now let me tell you something that's an adjunct of this. So I'm writing this book, and the book in its first chapter deals with the NAACP struggle to end segregation in the country, and the fact that the NAACP picked education as the central point of focus for its efforts at the start. And of course, this involves a man by the name of Charles Hamilton Houston, the former dean of Howard University's law school. And he picked a cadre of young lawyers. He developed them at Howard, right here in Washington. And one of those young lawyers was none other than a man by the name of Thurgood Marshall. And begins to work with these young people and makes the case to them that a lawyer who is nothing, a lawyer who is not a social architect is nothing but a social parasite. And impresses on them the idea that they are going to have to become social engineers as lawyers. So in this first chapter, there are some amazing stories to be told, moments like when Charles Hamilton Houston and Thurgood Marshall, fresh from law school, go down south for the NAACP during the summer of 1933. And Marshall and Houston are traveling in an old jalopy. They've got bags of food, blankets, pillows on the back seat. Because remember, these are two black men traveling through the South, so they can't stop at hotels. They can't be sure that any restaurant will serve them. And they get way down into Mississippi, into the Delta, almost to the Louisiana line. And Houston goes in an old shack of a school. And the school, when I say that, don't imagine a building because there's no roof to the shack. It's just four wooden walls. There's no blackboard in the front. The teacher simply scrawls with a piece of charcoal on the wooden wall. And there's really no place for the kids to sit, and the place is not filled. There are very few kids in there. But Houston's in there because he wants to create a record of the difference between schools available to black children and white children. It will become the basis of his lawsuit, this differential. Standing outside is Thurgood Marshall, the young law student, watching the car, eating a sandwich, and he's pulled an orange out for his dessert. A little boy approaches, about 8 years old, and stares at young Thurgood Marshall, then easily 6'3", 6'4", skinny as a beanpole, standing next to this car, and just fixates on him. And Thurgood Marshall stares back at the kid, says hello, but the kid won't say a word, and then says to the kid, "Are you hungry?" Kid won't respond. But the kid keeps circling around, looking at Thurgood Marshall. Marshall says, "Shouldn't you be in school?" Kid doesn't respond. But the kid keeps circling around, staring. Finally, Marshall tears off a piece of the sandwich, offers it to the child. Child shakes his head. At least he got some response. But Thurgood Marshall's curious, what is wrong with this kid? Is he mute? Is he dumb? What's wrong with this kid? And then the child points at the orange. And Marshall, as I said, had been saving the orange for dessert, but he picks up the orange and offers it to the child. And at that point, the child grabs the orange. And Marshall says, "Oh, okay, I understand. Go ahead, eat it. You can have my orange." And the child takes it looks at it and bites at it right through the rind. And Thurgood Marshall's like, what are you doing? What are you doing? And the kid then bites down on the orange to penetrate the rind, and as he does so, the juice goes flying into his eyes, across his cheeks, drips off his chin, but the juice that got into his eyes stings him, and now the child starts to cry out and rub his eyes and makes it worse and takes the orange and flings it on the ground and splatters it. And Thurgood Marshall says, what the hell is wrong with you? You wasted my orange. Now you got it in your eyes. What is wrong with you, stupid kid? And here comes Dean Houston out of this building, hearing all this screaming. He would later say that he thought some crazed segregationist was attacking his young law student. Only to find it's an 8-year-old child and Thurgood Marshall screaming at the boy. He says, what's wrong with you, Thurgood? What are you doing? What have you done to this child? And Marshall says to him, Dean Houston, you don't understand. This kid took my orange, bit at it right through the rind, and now he's gotten it in his eyes and he's thrown it and wasted it in the mud. And Dean Houston said to him, you know, Thurgood, I don't think you understand what's going on here. You know, I signed your law degree, but I don't think you understand. Have you noticed that when someone invites us into their house at night to have a meal, and we ask to use the bathroom, we have to go out back. We have to be careful where we step because there are open troughs filled with human waste. Have you noticed that as we're driving along here, we don't see office buildings, we don't see factories? These people, Thurgood, are lucky if they can get the man in the big house to give them a piece of land in which they can be sharecroppers. And when it comes to a school for their children, Thurgood, and here he pointed to the shack, he says, this is what the people here have to offer their children. This is it, Thurgood. And you're going to stand here and you're going to scream at this little boy? Scream at this little boy because he doesn't know anything about peeling an orange, slicing an orange, taking the seeds out of an orange? He said, damn it, Thurgood, I don't think this kid's ever seen an orange before. Thurgood Marshall couldn't believe it. He'd grown up in Baltimore, and oranges were expensive and a treat, but a child who'd never seen an orange, never eaten an orange, was beyond his imagination that such a child existed in America. So he writes home to his mother, and here's the record. He writes home to his mother basically this message. Dear Mom, you know, Dean Houston used to say that a lawyer who's not a social architect is nothing but a social parasite. But I wanted to become Lawyer Marshall. I wanted to be somebody. I wanted to make some money. But today I met a kid who didn't know what an orange was. Wasn't in school. And Mom, I think somebody should be a voice for that child. I think somebody should let people know that child exists in America. And suddenly, the frat boy, the self-centered Marshall, has a sense of mission about what he can be in America. It informs the identity of the young lawyer who not only will challenge segregation in terms of schools, but of course go on to become the first African-American Solicitor General, first African-American on the Supreme Court. Now, I tell you that tale because so many of the young people who were writing stories about the civil rights movement, so many of the young people who were involved, for example, with Eyes on the Prize, had a really negative attitude about Thurgood Marshall. Because from their perspective, as people who were coming of age in mid-century, they viewed Marshall as a stuck-in-the-mud lawyer, an NAACP moderate to conservative in terms of civil rights activity, and specifically civil rights activism. Marshall was not marching anywhere. Marshall was not a fan of the Great March on Washington in 1963. Marshall was very skeptical about Dr. King, and he thought the idea of all these young SNCC people going south for Freedom Summer and the like, getting arrested, was simply creating a problem because it put their lives at risk by putting them in the hands of brutal Southern white sheriffs. So this is Thurgood Marshall's take, and of course Marshall, when he's put on the Supreme Court by President Johnson, is viewed by many as a simple token, someone who's put there to represent the idea of justice being available to all, and Marshall being someone who's pictured in political cartoons that you can find in your archives of that time, as using his gavel to hammer on the head of the likes of Stokely Carmichael and the other militants of the moment. And so for a lot of the young people, they viewed Marshall in his black robes, overweight, his thick glasses, as sort of an anachronism, out of touch with the spirit of the times, not deserving of their attention. So what a surprise it was to me in the course of my work to say, my gosh, you know, if you look at the roots of the civil rights movement in this country, if you get into the archives, what you come to understand is so much of this movement is rooted in the life and work of this man who may have been seen by people by mid-century as kind of old hat, but in fact clearly established the basis for shifting the parameters of the law, essentially overturning Plessy v. Ferguson, the 1896 Supreme Court ruling that said separate but equal could be the law of the land, to the point that we get Brown v. Board in 1954. So I continue along in my work, but I think what a fascinating character. I really want to do more research on Thurgood Marshall. Well, I come to find out that, of course, there's not much archival material. Much of it's closed, even closed by the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, citing things like lawyer-client confidentiality. Obviously, because he's alive, his work on the courts, his personal papers are closed. I'm thinking to myself, this is amazing. But he's alive, and he's in the same city that I live in, Washington, D.C. I'll request an interview. Well, when I was doing Eyes on the Prize, he turned me down flat. I appealed to his friends, to his family, people who were his law clerks. They said there's not a chance. Much of that had to do with two things. One, he had been belittled in the, I think it's 1979 book, The Brethren, written by my former colleague Bob Woodward and Scott Armstrong, reporters at the Post. In that book, Marshall is described often as the kind of person who comes in to work late in the morning, spends a lot of time watching TV, heavily reliant on his clerks to get his work done, not really of the intellectual caliber that would have merited a position on the Supreme Court, but someone who was put there, again, as a token. And Marshall was just devastated by this because he saw himself, to the contrary, as someone who had come onto the court and been involved in so many critical rulings, everything from Pentagon Papers to Roe v. Wade to establishing the rights of minorities in Baki, arguments about whether or not race could be a consideration for admission to higher education in the country. And he somehow sees himself not only in that way, but remember, there were no women on the court at that time. Today we have an incredible three on the court at one time, but then there were no women on the court, and Marshall was someone who, as a lawyer, had been involved in defending people who were charged with involvement in back alley abortions, and here he stood having this different point of view and feeling as if he was representing not just blacks, but Hispanics, women, Native Americans, everyone. And yet here he felt was this book, this hugely best-selling book, that made him out to be a clown. So he didn't want any part of reporters. And then the second part of this reluctance had to do with the fact that Carl Rowan, a black columnist, had started work with him on a biography, but that Rowan wanted to tell Marshall's story in terms of the difficulty of being black and the struggles that he faced, Marshall faced, as a black lawyer. He started the book by focusing on a trial in Hugo, Oklahoma, a trial that Marshall lost, where a man who was a black man who was slightly retarded was charged with the murder of a farm family. And despite the fact that there was no evidence, there was no weapon, no motive, and that even the family, the father of the farmer's wife, came forward to say that this young man had nothing to do with it, an all-white jury and a white judge found the young man guilty. There was a coerced confession involved. Marshall appealed, lost the appeal in the state Supreme Court, then lost the appeal in Washington. He was sure that he was going to win. And the idea that he had lost was such a bitter pill for him. But for Carl Rowan, it was evidence at the very start of the book that would establish the idea of the difficulty of the task that Marshall faced as a black lawyer. But when Marshall realized that Rowan was starting the book in this way, he cut off all communications. He didn't want any part of it. He felt that, you know what? I'm the Babe Ruth of American lawyers. I've won 29 of 32 cases I've argued before the court. I'm on the high court now, and you want to start with a case that I lost. That's like starting with the time Babe Ruth struck out. What are you doing? So he cut off all communications and, in fact, sent a check back to the publisher for $100,000. You'll never find me doing that, I tell you. But it was at that juncture that I had finished Eyes on the Prize. I saw this report in the paper about Marshall cutting off his relationship with Rowan. And it was just then that I persisted in writing notes, sending them up there. And guess what? I got a call. I got a call at my desk at the Washington Post. And I wasn't at my desk. And this was the old days when they didn't have the message machines, but instead had a secretary who would take a message. So it rang over to the receptionist, secretary, and she took a message that's the voice on the other end said, "This is Thurgood Marshall. I'd like to speak to Juan Williams." And the receptionist, who was a friend, knew that I had been reaching out to Marshall for some time and, of course, never getting a response. And so she said to him, "Yeah, right, I bet you're Thurgood Marshall." And he said, "No, this is Justice Marshall at the Supreme Court." And she said, "Look, I don't know who you are, Buster, but I don't have time for this." And blam, she hung up the phone on. But here's the good news. If you're a Supreme Court justice, you don't have to put up with this kind of foolishness. He rang right back, but this time he called the publisher of the newspaper, who at the time was Catherine Graham. And she took his call. And she put him in touch with the man who was then the editor of the paper, Ben Bradley, who then found his young reporter and said, "Hey, you know, Justice Marshall's trying to reach you." And I got on the phone and I made all sorts of apologies. And I said, "Why are you calling?" And he said, "I want you to come up here for tea at 4 o'clock. And I said, "Oh, why?" And bam, he hung up the phone on me. And I called around town to try to find out why all of a sudden is he calling me to, you know, come up and have tea. I mean, tea's okay with me, but what's this about? Nobody has a clue. I go up there, walk into his office, and his office is an archive. Oh, my gosh, what an incredible place it was. There on the wall was a skin, an animal skin, given to him by Jomo Kenyatta, because when Kenya was establishing its independence from Britain, they asked one lawyer in all the world to come and write the new constitution for Kenya, and that was Thurgood Marshall. And there on the wall is an original brief from the Brown decision signed by Marshall and his opposing attorney, John Davis, a man who was a segregationist, a man who was, as I recall, the Democrats' candidate for president back in 1924. And, of course, on the desk in front of Marshall was a bust of Frederick Douglass, someone who had grown up as a slave and, of course, gone on to be the great abolitionist, orator. And behind the desk was living history. There was Thurgood Marshall, you know, his eyes watering with glaucoma, thick white socks on his legs, you know, the kind of socks that help with circulation, a cane dangling off the corner of the desk. This was a moment in which you see history come alive. It's almost as if the archives now have legs and arms and voice. And he starts to tell stories. Stories, for example, such as the one about traveling through the South with Dean Houston. And it's at that moment that, for me, you come to understand the power of history. It's at that moment when Marshall then says, "You can see my papers." It's at that moment when he then says, "You know, I'll write a letter to the Legal Defense Fund asking them to open their archival material for you," that you come to start to understand the importance of having voices from the past inform us about who we are at this moment. You come to see that when it comes to our common sense of identity as Americans, and specifically in this time with so much change in the air, with so many young people, so many people coming from such a variety of divergent experiences, that the archival material that all of you watch over so carefully is really our most precious resource. It is, in truth, our family treasure as Americans. And when it comes to minority Americans, that treasure is without compare. And I would just appeal to all of you to have an understanding of what an important role, what a critical role it is that you play at this time in terms of forming the family story of America and making sure that all members of that family have a sense that they belong and that you care and are helping to preserve their family story. After I finished Eyes on the Prize, I had the chance to go around the country, because especially the PBS series, and talk to people about civil rights history. And one of the things that amazed me is how often people would say, "Oh, well, you know, I just wasn't aware of what was going on then back in the 50s and 60s. They'd say, you know, their parents told them, "Oh, that's trouble on the other side of town. Don't pay attention, black or white." Or they'd say, "You know what, I had pimples back then. I didn't go out much," that kind of thing. But, you know, after signing books and shaking hands, when I get home, I often think to myself, you know, these people weren't talking to me. I think these people are filled with regret that now people are digging into the archives, telling that story in terms of books, in terms of documentaries, in terms of even movies, and they realize they were alive during this period and they didn't get involved. They didn't make a difference. And as I'm speaking to all of you, given all that you're up against every day, from budget cuts to personnel cuts to people who don't appreciate or understand the vitality of an archive, to know-nothing politicians who are just anxious to say, you know what, oh, well, we can just hold off on that expense for now because we've got a budget crunch, and that archival material will be there as if it doesn't have an expiration date and doesn't need to be properly processed. And as Pat was telling me, especially in this era of technology, need to be preserved in a format that will allow us to access it in the future. All of this is on you. All of this is the daily reality of your lives. I understand. But I don't want you to come back to a meeting of this society in 5 or 10 years, and people say to you, "Did you understand the importance of the work that you were doing as archivist? In that moment of tremendous change, in that moment in which America was going through so much change, not just with the black president, but in terms of the immigration, in terms of the growth of the minorities, in terms of the role of women, in terms of education, educational opportunities, and class divisions and generational divides, did you understand the power of being an archivist in that moment?" And I hope that all of you are the kind of people who would say yes. We kept our eyes on the prize. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Not only did you reinforce the importance of what we do, and we need that at times, we can stand pats on the back, but I think also your description of the role we can play with young people. I think many of us understand we're a place young people come to understand our collective past, but I think the way you articulated that we may also have the power to spark their imagination or inspire them about what they can be. I think that's a slightly new perspective for me to think about the role our archives can play. So thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.